Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Chasing the Sun by Richard Cohen. It's a 360-page book, which is going to be an awful lot of podcasting, and it's a sort of eclectic but very deep book by someone who isn't an academic. So if they're not an academic, it turns out to be a really good thing overall, because just the way that they can get into the work via different methodologies, so they can actually give a story and build a little bit of information on that story to give you sort of some sort of presence in with it. It's closer to a novel than an actual academic work. Just to give you a background on this Richard Cohen before we launch into this 360 pages. Richard Cohen is a former publishing director of the Hutchinson and Holder Slotin and the founder of Richard Cohen Books, i.e. we don't know who he is. The acclaimed author of By the Swords, The History of Gladiators, Basketeers, Samurai, Swashbucklers, and the Olympic Games. He has written for The Times, Guardian, Independent, and most other leading newspapers, and has appeared on the BBC, radio, and television. He lives in New York City. So, this is actually a very, very good read, a refreshing read. Just a little bit of context before we begin. The aim of this is not to actually become a famous podcaster, but to get up to speed, a bit more cognitive rehabilitation, reading and speaking. I've had sort of my circuit's fried inside my head, and just to match it, my little dictaphone, which I'm podcasting in, also had its circuits fried. I sort of read into about a chapter of it so far. I could hear just how dreadful I was. And I'm sort of sympathetic because the actual circuits on my dictaphone is fried. Fortunately, I've got a backup dictaphone, which I sort of can compare and fault test between the two. And then to make it worse, the actual weather in Australia is absolutely hot, and then there were thunderstorms such that you couldn't hear what was going on. So now it's nice and cool, perfect podcasting weather, and I'll just start reading it. So first off, I'm going to read the preface to you. So just to give you an overview, there's part one, the Sun Before Science, consisting of four chapters. Discovering the Sun, the First Astronomers, another four chapters. Eight chapters, part three, Sun and Earth, part four, Harnessing the Sun, part five, Inspired by Stars, part six, The Sun and the Future. So this is actually gives a fair amount to it. We're going to read it. So it's a fairly big book, 581 pages to go. And these are pages, pre-pages, before you even get going. And it's beautiful. It's a beautifully written book with a lot of information in it. So what's happened is this guy has collected heaps and heaps of information, arranged it, put a great life effort into it. And unfortunately, it's not a fantastically well-known book, but it's a book nonetheless that people know that I'm into reading in-depth studies of things and have given me this book, so thank you very much for a Christmas present for it. Now, I should mention the fact that as you read journals and you read different things, you tend to get an idea of different sorts of academics or non-academics, and the entire idea of we're living in this population of 7 billion people. A majority of people spend their time playing sports and just lugging around by pools, drinking martinis or whatever they do, but they don't research and understand things. So this is a rarity, and really it's, if you want to be by yourself in a population of 7 billion people, you just have to do some research, and very quickly you've got no friends. But let's read about this. Here's a quote. And what I'm going to do is, before I give the quote, I'll say where the quote's from. The quote's from Harold Hay, a pioneer of solar energy, and it's now in his 102nd year, so he's probably still not alive. Okay. Once we begin to go back to a closer understanding of nature and man's relationship to the sun, we're going to start developing a whole new concepts on who we are and why and what our rightful place in the universe really is. It seems like a quote that you want at the start of a book. I don't necessarily, it's a very good quote. This one's from Sherlock Holmes, The Hound of the Baskervilles. You can see I'm slowly gaining a bit of podcasting skills by saying where the quote is before you actually listen to it. I think you need that, and also a little bit, a few little skills. So from Sherlock Holmes says this: "The world is full of obvious things which nobody by any chance ever observes." Which is so true. That majority of people just are unobservant. Volume 4 of the Encyclopedia of Astronomy and Astrophysics defines the sun as a... Can you define the sun? Or describes, I would say describes it. A main sequence, yellow dwarf, spectral type G subscript 2 V, mass 1.989 by 10 to the 30 kilograms diameter, 1,392,000 kilometers, luminosity 3.83 by 10 to the 26 watts, an absolute visual magnitude of plus 4.82. Now, this is a podcast, so I'm going to explain some of this as we get through. So, main sequence. There are two types of stars. There's things, stars which are on the main sequence, and they're burning hydrogen fuel, and they have this story. And it's called a main sequence because we have a plot. If you plot on the x-axis color and on the y-axis brightness, all the stars will form a line. So the very brightest, it's actually back to front for what you actually think in terms of colour. You start off with red and start off with blue and you go to red. So the bluest stars are the hottest stars, and that forms a line. And essentially what happens is that the star lights up and undergoes a long period of burning in its main sequence. It's called a main sequence. That's just a term that we've gone. And, it's a bit of a misleading term. It's because a star doesn't enter the main sequence and travel along. It enters this region of brightness and colour where it's doing just hydrogen burning. It does it for most of its lifetime. And it's not a sequence, and this is one of the confusing terms from. So that's a historical term, main sequence, and afterwards it becomes brighter and redder, becomes a red giant. So it actually moves. If you can imagine on this page, the star moves in this plot. So you can plot the star; it gets brighter and changes colour all the time. And it moves off to the right of the main sequence above when it forms a red giant. It goes out with the stars, generally go out with a bang, and then the dead star is to the left and underneath the main sequence. I assume this is dead stars here. Okay, it's a yellow dwarf star. Yellow is its main spectral line. So stars have a series of colours. Now, the colours are actually indicated, are determined by physics, and so a single number can describe the colour of a star, It's the general majority of light coming out of a star is one thing. So you can have, stars can go from infrared, red, orange, yellow, blue, violet, ultraviolet X-rays. It skips green, a series of colours. So, in your visual field, your chroma something or other, this is your colour chart. It's often plotted as a colour sphere, sort of a triangle, a bit like a shade sail. And you've got the response of two cones in your, the two cone responses in your eyes, your visual perception chart. So you can see this whole millions of colours in this projection chart. Around the outside of the boundary are laser lines. I'm just giving it to you anyway. And coming into this, coming for the red and going into the white and blue, is this little eyelash of line. And that's the black body lines, which are the allowed colours of stars. So stars can't be of any colour. They've got a restricted, really restricted range of colours. And the colours are named by a single number. The colour index is called. And we've got a yellow colour index. And the colour index is really important because that tells you where in your graph of all stars. So we can get all stars, no matter where they are, but actually map their properties, we can get their colour. Now the mass is 1.9 by 10 to the, roughly 2 by 10 to the 30 kilograms. To the 30 means, just, he's got the correct units here. It's got, 30 means 30 zeros, so that's, if you stick out your hand, 30 zeros, stick out your hand and your little pinky, because it's million, 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 million kilograms, okay, of mass. The diameter is 1.3 1.4 million kilometers. Luminosity is what you call absolute brightness, or the amount of watts coming out of a star. And so if you actually look at it, each kilogram of the sun is putting out, it's in the order of a 0.1 of a milliwatt. So each kilogram of star is of the sun is putting out an incredibly small amount of power, if you look at it. And its absolute visual magnitude is 4.82 plus 4.82. Now, his visual magnitude, you've got to get view, is that, I have to really go back and check this, because there's the visual magnitude scale is given from the really ancient Greeks. It's like the ancient Greeks came up with this visual scale, and it's sort of a logarithmic scale, and it's a visual scale. So the brightest star would be a 1, and the next brightest star would be a 2, 3, 4, I think they've got up to 6. And I think the difference between a 1 and a 2 is 5. Don't quote me on that. An absolute visual brightness means that if I've compensated for distance, for distance. So what this means is the larger your visual magnitude, the larger your number there, the dimmer it is. So it's back to front. And I think the change of 1 is a factor of 5 difference. I just have to really go back. I can't remember. I haven't done any revision for this. I've just read this, and so it's just off my databanks. And bear in mind that all my memories have been fried, so this is the whole idea of reading this. So it's 5. Now, we're going to get to the end of this book eventually, but let's stop and explain everything. And the absolute brightness is, I get a star, and I bring it artificially to 3.2 light years away, or one arc second is an artificial, a parsec. We bring it to one parsec away. Maybe 10 parsecs? I have to get back. So I really have to read that. So after this, I'm going to, when I publish this, I'll read it and give it to you. But the stars have put it a particular distance from us. I think my memory is parsecs, is 10 parsec. Again, this is just, I have no recollection. I cannot remember it. If you can believe, I cannot actually recall anything. I just have the information there as accessible. I have no idea whether it's right or wrong. It's a really confusing thing for me. But I thought I'd do this, and sort of reading this, obviously, you can see how this boosts the memory. So that's the distance. Okay. And again, that... I'm just going to read what he says here. That is certainly one way of looking at the star, although, as Bert Wooster put it, not the sort of thing to spring on a lad with a morning head. Okay, that's not going to interest people. But I think because this is a bad scientific explanation, there's not other fantastic scientific explanations out there. That's my own personal viewpoint. But this person, as I've read into the book, has got another great way of describing the sun, but it sort of avoids the science of it. So this is a scientific description using scientific terms. It does not describe the science of it. So look, I could describe an aircraft by telling you the number of elements, the fuel, the thrust and stuff like that, but it would, and we could write up poems about aircraft, but the aerodynamics, the science of the aircraft is not there. So this is what I feel about this particular book. It's great, but it's missing the actual science of why things works. Okay, so this is perhaps good, because if you don't know why things works, you can be, you don't stop, you keep on going. This is quite good to read this book. We describe the sun in a myriad of ways and comprehend it variously too. Okay, so I was just reading that they've got a double zero, that's a double O, and that's correct for that one. So that's because we understand it different ways, we've got different explanations. Good. The Indian sages who wrote the Riga Vita between the 8th and 4th century BC assumed a tome of oral reference. Quote, one only when illuminating light shines, capital L for light, so that's a goddess. Everything else shines. And this is interesting. I don't understand. Sorry, I can't. This has got a slant. So I don't understand why they use the slant. The entire universe, while the philosopher... shines the entire universe. Okay, while the philosopher Martin Gordiano Bruno described the sun with 16th century... Bruno, I'll give a quote from him, and then I'll have a bit of a talk about him. Apollo, author of poetry, quiver bearer, bowman of powerful arrows, Pythian laurel crowned, prophetic shepherd, seer, priest, and physician. Okay, so Bruno was your an autistic savant, a memory savant, who came in and didn't respond well to people telling him to shut up. And he famously said, why can't there be other planets and other religions and other people in every star? So he believed that the star was like the sun. It's pretty amazing. And that... there's a whole heap of things out there. Just to give you a background, he was pre-Galileo, 16th, he was pre-Galileo, and he was going around, just on the time of Galileo. Oh, no, pre-Galileo. So when they burnt him at 1600, They burned him in Vatican, just outside the Sistine Chapel. They torched him. Because they torched him, Galileo took the idea of the church rather seriously. However, he believed in a lot of things. Just to put it in, he basically was kicked out of every country of Europe because he was initially friended, but then he would upset the people there. So he was kicked out of Italy, kicked out of Germany, kicked out of France, went to Britain, he stayed with John Diggs. So John Diggs is the famous British astronomer. Around this time, a star exploded, and when the star exploded, that caused a whole heap of problems. Because people really didn't know exactly what stars were, and when it exploded, it meant that the star, the heaven, they weren't just decorations up there. They were something else was going on, and so this is the idea that the stars weren't on a painted sheet, a painted backdrop. They were actually a physical space. So John Diggs there talked about the celestial sphere, it was called. The idea it was a wall, a sky. It wasn't a layer of sky up there, it was something more to it. So he actually believed that there were many planets, and it turns out that all the people in history, he was the one person who actually got the idea that there was planets around every star. And we have found at the moment that there's 1.2 planets around every star we've looked at. So he's a really interesting person. I'll have to read a bit more about him. He's such a fantastic, he's my favourite person, Bruno. So this is interesting that you've got so much information packed in there. Sherlock Holmes, main sequence, luminosity, Bruno, fantastic. I really like him. So this is one of the problems that when you read, you've got so much information already that people who with little information or little attention read a lot more quickly and read a lot more lightly. So you're in for this podcast, and we're barely through the first page of the preface. Without the sun, none of us would exist. Our star, formed out of a vast cloud of hydrogen and stardust, has been active for 4.6 billion years and has enough fuel for a further 10 billion years at the present rate. But continuing solar convulsions will shorten the life to a mere 5 billion more. Okay, so that's roughly correct. So our star moved on to the main sequence, as we call it. So it's, main sequence is a region of activity, colour to luminosity. It moved on to the main sequence at 4.6 billion years ago. And it's could stay on the main sequence for a huge long time, except it's he said solar convulsions, but that's actually not correct. There's two fuel burning processes. One is 4P, four protons. The other one's a CNO process. Now the CNO process is carbon being produced inside your star, and as carbon builds up inside the star, this more efficient thing just burns more quickly. So if you can imagine a log fire, nice and warm, but if you imagine your log fire burns and it turns into sudden rocket fuel, your little log fire will suddenly burst into flame. That's the best way I can explain it. Now, the CNO cycle is necessary. You've got to produce carbon. So what happens is if the star gets bright enough, big enough, it will ignite on the CNO cycle. And so if you look at the main sequence, it's got this elbow in it. This is the two burning mechanisms. And we're just on the edge of the elbow, and we're going to pick up and burn. So our star is going to fall into the CNO cycle. I think we've got 1% of our energy at the moment comes from the CNO cycle. So let's try and describe that a little bit more. You can get the triple alpha. So alpha means, an alpha particle means a helium nuclei. A triple alpha means that two carbon nuclei come together and form a carbon. So carbon is 12 with 6, 12 nucleons, 6 protons, 6 neutrons. And so that's made up of three carbons of 2 protons, 2 neutrons each, and it forms across. Now, the triple alpha is one of the, before we knew a whole lot of other spooky things to say, or God is doing this, the triple alpha transition requires this incredible alignment of energy levels to allow the star to push up and lock away the carbon. And so before people discovered a whole lot of other things, evidence of God, they thought this is a God transition. So the carbon buildup is an important aspect. And when the carbon builds up, the carbon itself can act as a catalyst and it actually builds up a little bit. The carbon actually builds up in weight as the protons hit it, and it goes from carbon to nitrogen, nitrogen to oxygen, oxygen back to carbon with the emission of a alpha particle coming out of it. So the CNO cycle picks up off, and so this is why a big star burns so brightly for two reasons. So the star's a little bit bigger than us. It burns a lot more fiercely. So you increase the mass a little bit, the brightness increases, and the brightness increases for, so imagine you have a little MIDI car with a, say you've got a 1-ton car with a 100-liter engine. If you have a 2-ton car with a 200-liter engine, the actual engine, the acceleration is much bigger and all that stuff. The range is much shorter. It will chew through its fuel much more quickly, simply because it's got a whole lot of other things happening. It will travel a lot faster. It will burn throughout the place. It will just accelerate a lot more quickly, but it's got a different process, a different engine. You know, so your bigger stars actually have a shorter lifetime. Okay, so it's not, because it's not convulsions, it's in time, and the entire idea of our star, incredibly, is it's like you see turbulence and flares, that's okay, that's on the outside, but you go down 2/3, it's actually in what we call the radiation zone, incorrectly, it's the conduction zone inside the star, so it's perfectly still on the inside, so it's not convulsing at all. So that's a bit misled. Even bigger stars than our star are so big that they actually do have convulsions on the inside, and that's a really interesting thing to see, or start different stages go through like this. Okay, let's continue reading. The Earth famously averages a distance of 93 million miles from it. Oh, okay. Look, okay. I have to convert that for you to metrics. In metric, our distance from the sun varies from a 150 million miles in the Australian summer, but by the time we're on the opposite side for the European summer, it's 152 million kilometres. Okay. The sun's core burns at a sustained 15 million C. That's a bit confusing. It's 150 million C, and it's there because the heat can't get out. But it's like it's putting out the same heat as a compost heap. It's sort of it's really composting, stuff like that. It's not burning. There's nuclear fusion. I suppose you might call it burning. To give a sense of perspective, a single photon from the sun's core takes 150,000 years just to reach the frontier of space. Let's try and help you on that one. It takes a million years, but this book I wouldn't confer. It takes a long time. Now, it takes so long because the light is not travelling at the speed of light. It's travelling via conduction, the same process of conduction, and it just takes that length of time for the heat. If I lit a match for the heat to travel to the outside world. So the difference between light and heat is different here. So just to give you an idea, say if you get a poker, something that you could break. Typically, I think it's easiest for you to imagine a glass or a plate or something like that, that you put in the kiln, and you pick it out of the kiln while it's still hot. If you break it, you can see that it's hot inside and it will glow from the inside. So the sun is glowing on the inside and that heat is travelling off. So I don't know if you've ever had typically, people, just to be annoying, will throw in a river stone into your campfire and it will explode due to the heat gets in and the gas. But if you do have such a stone and you crack it open, you can see that it's hottest on, it'll cool on the outside, and when you break it, you'll see it glow on the inside. And that is conduction. So there's nothing amazing about taking that long. That's just the conductivity, the light conductivity within something. So a rock, so the major way that heat travels in a metal is through the electrons. I don't know where this comes from. If you study solid state physics, you don't have one particle bouncing against the other, because they're spring loaded in the electrons. So if you shake an atom, you just move it inside its electron. It's sort of perfectly wrapped. But it will transmit energy via its electrons, or in the case of something solid, it will put it through its by the emission of light. So basically, it's black body radiation inside a blanket will eventually heat up the blanket to make itself a complete black body radiator. I'll try and explain it a bit more. Every second, 5 million metric tons of mass are converted into nuclear energy, the equivalent of a detonation of 90,000 million 1 megaton hydrogen bombs. A scientist expresses it. He's got something which is completely not SI. I won't offend your ears with it. So that's 5 E=mc². So it's 5 million tons of energy. So essentially, you put 3.83 by 10 to the 26. I have the convenience that I can turn the page. You can't turn the page back here. Watts. And per second, you divide that by 3 by 10 to the 8. So that's just roughly 3 to 10 to 8. That's 10 to the... That's 3 by 10 to the 9 tons. A ton. Just in the way I get it, I don't get that number in my head doing that calculation. Let's see what they say. 3 by 10 to the 26. So it's 3 by 10 to the 10. So that's 3 by 10 to the 10. You've got a 3, take away 3. That's 10 to the 10 divided by 3. That's roughly 3 by 10 to the 9. 10 to the 9 is... I get 3 million tons in my calculation. And he says... And he says over here, doing your head in, And just sorry, I'm taking around 5 million. I get 3 million metric tons by the way that I calculate it. So that's a bit strange. So that's a huge amount of helium produced. I get closer to 3 million metric tons by just doing a calculation in my head. Oh, no, it's 3.8. Okay, it's closer to 4 million metric tons, just doing a calculation in my head. Yet the Earth receives 1 on 2.2 billionth of the output. Oh, dear. He's put a 1 slant, 1.2, and it's either 2.2 billionths or... You put 1 on 1.2.2 to the billion. Or billion. Is I've done that one. I think it's so startlingly small that 120 years ago it was one of the talking points of science. Where was all that power going? I don't understand why. You need a bit more evidence. The sun accounts for 99.8% of the mass of the entire solar system. But as time goes by, while continue to expand at an accelerating pace, it will inexorably draw in on itself and lose some of that mass. Although 1,300,000 Earths could fit inside it. So this is volume. So I don't understand. He's talking about mass and volume. But the volume that goes, the Earth is, I don't know, roughly a hundredth of its diameter. 100 times 100 times 100 is a million. So it's a million. That's how much the volume is from the diameter. So that's a bit confused. About 2 billion years from now, a far cooled star, it will widen at great speed into a highly luminous red giant, and suddenly collapse into a white dwarf. Alas, scientific vocabulary is rarely poetic. All life on Earth having long since been extinguished. And further trillion years, which is 1,000 billion years, it will have frozen to ultimate cold. That's just bizarre. He said it's only got 5 billion years, and now he says it's 2 billion years. So this hasn't been edited by a scientist. Going across it. And yeah, he's got, there's lack of understanding that. Perhaps we'll read it, and perhaps I'll be able to talk about it. In the early 1900s, this is the next section, while running a publishing house in London, I decided I wanted to learn more about the sun. No sudden epiphany, just realization that I knew so little about it. Above all other things, governs our lives. My problem is that the early 1990s. Sorry, I thought the 1900s. I'm so stupid. That's why I stopped there. So that's okay. If it was the 1900s, it's okay. 1990s. And went looking for an author to write a wide-ranging account without success. Wasn't it lovely? These publishers want to find things and find it out. I left England for New York with the idea still in my head and wondered whether the intervening period someone had written a book that explained how the great ball of gas exercises its enormous and varied effects, specifically how it creates and maintains life on Earth in all its diversity. A visit to the New York Library revealed 5,836 titles under the sun, but none offered both the excitement of scientific discovery, Galileo first detecting blemishes on the sun, or William Herschel's identifying a new planet, which is not to do with the sun, of course, and exploration of the sun's place in art, religion, literature, mythology, or politics. I wanted to know more about the god. Great solar temple standing amid the ruins of Mishupushu, Mozart celebrating the sun, the magic flute, Charlie Chaplin mocking Hitler's love of the sun's imagery in The Great Dictator, and why 1,500 years the civilized West stuck with the ancient notion of the sun circling the earth. But most volumes aimed at the specialized area. and the non-scientists who tackled a particular aspect either looked askance at the science or took minimal interest in it. And I must admit, this grabs me, that you read these books which people, really, scientists have ignored, and they don't get to the fact, the people try and avoid the fact that they don't stop it and say, look, I don't understand this. Okay. Quote, there are two worlds, wrote the essayist Lee Hunt. The world that we can measure with line and rule, and the world that we feel with our hearts and imagination. Conan Doyle even has Sherlock Holmes assert that he doesn't want to know about the solar system, as that would take up brain space better devoted to more pertinent material. Some people still find this such a view sympathetic, and I think that's unfortunately the majority of people. If they can't make a buck out of it, and yeah, it's upset, they will just push you aside. You definitely know that when you're in the rehab doldrums. Back in 2003, I recall, so that's 13 years, I recall telling the biographer, Richard Holmes, then just setting out to write on a group portrait of early 19th century British scientists that would become the Age of Wonder, okay, name dropping there, that I intended to follow up my previous work, a 3,000 year history of sword fighting, with one about the sun. Ah, he said, first the study of honour, and now one about belief. Maybe he is right, but I began with no particular agenda. The sun is wonderful, literally full of wonders. I wanted to know more about it. So that's interesting, that these people who enter in through asking one question, it opens up to others. This meant that I had to learn nearly all the science. So you haven't learnt much, mate. For me, a daunting work, as my secondary school was run by a Benedictine monks who had little time for such disciplines, and my main memory I have of any scientific endeavour is of a black-robed, white-haired Father Brennan climbing through the window in our classroom carrying a large copper pan and Bunsen burner, proceeding to fry an egg, well, obviously with an egg as well. He told us science would always have a practical end in mind. Many scientists and science watchers would disagree, but I enjoyed my egg. Okay, my problem here is how many people would have that egg, how enjoyable it would be. I don't know. Okay, it's obviously. The book has taken 8 years to complete, over which time I have visited 18 countries on 6 of the 7 continents. During these years, my wife would frequently be asked about my whereabouts. Oh, she'd reply, he's out chasing the sun. Some of the readers may wish that I had ventured deeper into solar astronomy, but this book is not a rainbow. It has an end somewhere. Well, that, I don't know, that's eloquently put, but somehow frustrating. What I came to realize was that in the Western world especially, our relationship with the sun has gone astray. Having cracked the code of our star's great power, the miracle of nuclear fusion, we have discovered new wonders in the sun, but something of value has been lost in the process. Perhaps he's right. Perhaps people are bored with science. They sort of, I think we've CGI'd us into a stupor. CGI stupor, I would diagnose. Once upon a time, we thought that we were at the centre of the universe, that even the sun, as well as the moon and planets, revolved around us. We were then, we were the centre of everything. Well, to be fair, the actual, if you follow the reasoning, they said, you know, we have to be stationary because if we're moving, we can feel wind, and we don't feel any wind, so I'm a bit more tolerant of them. Yet, not having mastered any of primal forces that determine our lives, we are keenly aware of our own powerlessness. Hence our longing for mastery, as expressed so vividly in mythology, in the innumerable stories of men or gods or animals trying to control the sun, a longing for supremacy and satisfaction only through magical thinking, as we had no other means at our command. So, essentially, magical thinking. I like this because it says magical thinking is a drug. It's a drug which gives authority and essence and cohesion to our society, this magical thinking. And for me, I can see how this is challenging it. Thousands of years later, we know for a fact that our earliest, most basic idea about our place in the cosmos was false, and that the cosmos is vastly larger than we ever dreamed. We are mere specks, or I'd say nanospecks, that at the same time we have created for ourselves powers far beyond any we could have imagined. And a decade into the new century, solar scientists believe we are on the edge of a golden age of discovery about our star, and pose to answer such vexing questions as what causes sunspots and drives solar wind. You know, really odd, like, that is a vexing question. What drives the solar wind? We've got the little bits of it. We know where the power is coming from, what it does, how. We haven't got the full picture across. How the sun rays can bring us usable energy, and how magnetic particles, and coronal ejections affect our climates. The particles are just standard particles, and the magnetic field gets involved. I think he's missed the point there. So as our understanding of the sun has increased, along with our ability to harness it, we have stripped the primitive magical quantities. I think this is... No, I don't think there's causal... There's one scientist doing it, and there's another person who wants the magical powers. It's the effect of its magical powers. So we reduce the effect of magic. The American astronomer John Eddy understood this. Quote, "We have always wanted the sun to be better than our other stars and better than it really is. We wanted it to be perfect. And then when the telescope came along, it showed it wasn't. We said at least it's constant. And when we found it's inconstant, we said at least it's regular. Now it seems to be none of these. Why we thought it should be when other stars are not says more about us than it says about the sun." Well, that is a brilliant, brilliant quote. This book is therefore part of a desacralization of the universe, using the sun as an emblem of an ancient but ever stronger process about our sense of loss, sometimes conscious, sometimes not, as the wonder has been stripped away. That's person's great. Yeah, this is the whole thing of expressing these complex thoughts. But it's more than that. Our star has also inspired artists across the centuries. Sometimes it is the direct subject of their creation, sometimes a symbol of what they have wanted to convey, infusing their work with an authority, even majesty, that no other force could match. 8 years into my subjects, I've come to feel that the sun has powers that are well beyond our understanding, mythic indeed. We haven't at all managed to reduce it to just a scientific little luminary dwindled to a ball of blazing gas, as the fervent sun worshipper D.H. Lawrence put it. The ball of gas still has mysteries of magnitude so cosmic that perhaps only the grandeur of myth can encompass what we know about the sun's world-destroying, world-birthing powers and about its eventual death. You know, as I read this, I think this person, it's hard to say, there's this... when you get into a subject, you have this lucidity that evaporates when you begin to hold information together, and then it all disappears. So I think there's going to be a lot of junk information. Interesting, but junk information. Considering global warming, we have been told that science is settled, that greenhouse gases threaten the planet. I appreciate to ask whether that this is the prime cause precipitating changes to our environment will risk having this book branded as attracted against common sense, as my three children have repeated to tell me. There is no doubt that we are witnessing extreme droughts, floods, epidemics, and food shortages, along with the accelerating disappearance of species and abrupt changes to animal behaviour. Yet many of the world's leading solar physicists have told me that the coming golden age of discoveries about the sun is likely to bear directly on how we understand what is happening to our planet's climate, and the fact that the revelations may dwarf what we currently know about man-made global warming. We will ignore the research, as even major cataclysms have to be our doing. As even major cataclysms has to be our doing and not the governing star. To be sure, we are not blameless, but neither are we ruinously all-powerful. It is as if it offends us to think that we are still at the sun's mercy, but we are. And, of course, the sun has no mercy. See, that's a beautiful thing. Isn't that beautiful? We are at the sun's mercy, but the sun has no mercy. That's a beautiful way of putting it. The lessons I've learned in writing this book is that the sun gets into everything. One evening in 2004, while sitting at the Carlo Hotel in Madison Avenue, I found myself in the midst of half a dozen masters of the foxhound, men and women resplendent in hunting pink, there to attend a grand dinner. It transpired that true members of the blood dread days dread days when the sun is shining, as the heated atmosphere rises, lifting the fox's scent high beyond their pax's nose, and their quarry makes its escape. I cannot think of how else I might have pulled such a sunny detail out of the air. The US Scouting Service in 2009 website promotes a game centered on the sun, albeit one with scant regard for astronomical realities. It's like musical chairs, the author writes. There is one fewer chairs than the boys. Extra boy is the sun. The other boys are assigned a planet's name, Mars, Jupiter, etc. The sun orbits around the chairs, calling out the planet's names. The planet boy gets up and walks and orbits around the chairs with the sun. When all the planets are orbiting, the leader yells, "Blast off!" All the boys scramble to the chair. The one left standing becomes the sun. Well, please take your chairs. It's time for blast off. Okay, that's the very first reading, and we're just at page one of this huge, huge book to get through. And hopefully my reading has improved. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.